Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. You may think you know everything there is to know about sex, but there are many myths surrounding human sexuality that you might still believe. We'll be welcoming sex expert Martha Kempner, author of 50 Great Myths of Human Sexuality, to help debunk some of them. We'll be putting to rest once and for all whether penis size truly matters or how much it matters, whether bisexuality and sexual addiction are real, whether single people are having better sex than married people, and whether grandpa and grandma are still doing it. These myths range from the serious, like HIV and problems with female orgasms, to the light, like whether goat weed works or whether porn creates problems. This show is guaranteed to blow your mind, and I mean that in every sense of the word. It's going to be fun. Martha, welcome.
Thank you.
You're going to be fun, Martha.
Okay, good.
Okay. So the only rules here are there are none. So you can say anything you want, anything, any way, any question. It's really going to be all about you and your amazing book, which you wrote, which was a very, very fun read, by the way.
Thank you. That's okay. What we were hoping for.
You know, and after our program, I'm going to give everyone the information of how to get it, and you need to get it in order to get it. So let's start out with this question. Okay. There's ignorance in every area of one's life. You know, people really live in their own bubble. At the end of the day, which is one of my favorite expressions, my wife tells me I use too much. We all think the world is what it is through our own eyes, and actually, it's just our world, not the world. But I want you to tell me, what are some of the greatest misunderstandings that we have about human sexuality?
What are they?
Name me some. Name me some of those myths.
Well, I mean, I think the unfortunate thing is they're pretty much on every aspect of human sexuality, because as a society, we don't want to talk about it. So we have myths about our bodies. Penis size is a big
one. Let's talk about penis size. You know, and here's why I want to talk about penis size. I just told you, executive life coaching.
Right.
You know, I treat some of the most powerful people in the world, and yet what would bring them to their knees is their inner fear that they're just not adequate enough.
Yeah.
And then some men who are actually very tall, large hands, large feet, who have small penises. So what is the truth as you understand it about penis size and the ability for a woman to enjoy sex, and how important is it for a woman to have a large penis in her?
You know, I think it's not nearly as important as most men think it is.
That's why lesbians rock.
the average penis is in the 5-inch range, and that's perfectly adequate for most women. And in fact, more women are afraid that penises will be too big and will hurt than they are that they'll be too small. And it's all about, I mean, it's cliche, but it's all about what you do with it and not what it is. It's the only penis you're ever going to have. So, you know, you should probably enjoy it.
It's what you do with it. Okay. I think that is completely true. But I also think that it's also the perception of the woman and where she is in life. I think that from my experience, what I find is that the person who's never married and has never had a child or two or 10, okay, they have a different sense of whether or not, you know, when a woman has had many children and the vagina is stretched, somehow she feels that maybe she needs more, and or the guy feels that maybe he's not large enough in order to fill her up. And that's where I feel a lot of this comes from, meaning within, you enter into the vagina, there's only 3 inches of nerve endings. After those three inches, there's no nerve endings. You hit the cervix, there's no nerve endings. So you're right, 5 inches is more than enough. And in some cultures, and where penis size differs from, it's not too much, but it does differ from an Asian culture to an to a an East Indian culture to a Caucasian culture, but you know, not by a
there's
huge
a
amount.
Variance,
there's a little variance there. It goes somewhere between 4 and 6. So that's not.
It's really not much.
It's not much of a variance.
And I think the vagina, first of all, is very elastic, and it comes back from having a baby better than we think it is. Now, 10 or 20, 12 babies is a little different, but I think for the most part, the vagina will kind of eventually snap back is not the right term, but it will become – it will go back to the original size. And for some women, there is a desire to feel more full. But the truth is that for most women, intercourse is not their primary form of sexual pleasure. Their primary form of sexual pleasure is about the clitoris. And so intercourse is a little bit secondary. And what men can do, especially if they're a little worried about their penis size, is get really good at other things. Get really good with their fingers. Get really good with their tongues. Find some really good sex toys. I mean, if she wants something bigger, go buy her something bigger. But really, don't worry about the one you have.
And we forgot that for some women, it is really the size of the wallet and not the penis. You know, but let's not talk about those women right now.
Okay.
All right. If we look at the difference between real intimacy and the ability to understand the entire body and mind as being able to pick up senses of pleasure, every single part of the body, every single, you know, whether it's touching, grabbing, pulling, pinching, which will lead us to the 50 Shades of Grey question that I have for you. But that pleasure is not just about the penis and the vagina, and you're right. You know, it's definitely about the clitoris, but it's about the whole body. It's about the whole experience, and it's about having fun. It's about sex is supposed to be about regression and play and trust, you know, and We have made it – there's so many rules around it because from a worldwide perspective, there's – it's so protected. Sex is so protected culturally and religiously that, you know, for some, the whole pleasure aspect is just removed from it. So what I want to ask is that when we look at the world around us, are – you know, is how much ignorance is there about sex? And do you see any change happening on a much broader level than just in the United States, you know, and in Western Europe?
Well, I think there's a lot of ignorance about sex in general. Just to give you an example, and this is from the United States, I teach a college course right now called The Sociology of Sexuality. And we were discussing labiaplasty, which is one of the myths in the book about how your vagina or your vulva should look. And I realized in the middle of this discussion that half the people in this room didn't know what a labia was.
That's pathetic.
And that at least one of the women in the room didn't realize that your vagina and your urethra were two separate holes. And so she wasn't understanding the conversation for that reason. So I feel like, excuse me, right here in the United States, we have a lot of ignorance. And then the book really did focus on the way these myths play out here in the United States, but worldwide, I think we have even more ignorance because we really aren't. There are too many cultures are really uncomfortable talking about sex. I think Europe is a very different story.
Right,
but
Europe is a different story. We're behind Europe, obviously.
Absolutely.
You know, where sex is just simply part of everyday life, like coffee and croissants, and and it's something that is part of pleasure, and you live and you die and have as much sex as you can and make it safe. Now, some of the paranoia about – well, let's go back, by the way, to some myths about mm-hmm. the vagina in the United States.
You've got a lot of them.
Give me some vaginal myths.
Well,
and
first
penis
of all,
myths. Do you have any penis myths?
Well, the penis myths were a lot about the size, but to talk about the vagina, first of all, the myth is that the whole thing in between your legs is the vagina. Right? That is not the vagina. The vagina is the interior, the inside. Everything else is called the vulva as a kind of catch-all terms, and that's what you can see if you open your legs. You have labia, lips big and little, and you have a clitoral hood, and you have a clitoris and a urethra. So I think the fact that, you know, 80% of the United States isn't even using the right term for it says a lot about how squeamish we are about vaginas in general. And then I think the biggest myth about vaginas is that they smell bad. And they smell like vaginas. They basically – I had a great biology teacher.
That's so funny. They smell like, I'm going to stop you there because I'm going to say that everyone – has a different scent.
Absolutely.
So the truth of the matter is that vaginas don't smell bad. They smell like they smell, just the way each and every person, if you know, there's some people who cannot shower for 3 days and smell like a flower, and another person cannot shower for a day and smell like a sewer, meaning it's the way each person's body expresses themselves, and a lot of it, just like a baby's stool has to do with what it eats.
Right. And I think the problem is there's this whole industry out there that's trying to get us to think that our vagina smells bad because they want us to buy perfumes and soaps and special body washes for it. And we don't need any of those things. We just need to shower every once in a while and you're good.
Right. And this is true for those who are out, you know, dating. If you're dating someone and you don't like, forget about their vagina, if you don't like their body smell, it's not going to work out for you, okay?
It should be one of the parts that's actually very attractive.
You know, correct, meaning smell is something that immediately could excite or deter,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And it's not always has anything to do with cleanliness. Sometimes it does, but more often, most people, you know, are wise enough that before sex they'll take a shower. But I think the myth that the because the vagina is inside, or a woman's organ is more inside, it gets less exposure to the air and to being cleansed by the natural flow of air. So how much truth there is to that or not, it's really hard to say. But I think normal hygiene will just, you know, take care of that, right?
Right. And the vagina actually cleans itself by having some forms of discharge that come out. And also through menstruation, the vagina just is, you know, often referred to as a self-cleaning oven.
A self-cleaning oven. Okay. That is something that we're going to use one day. Is that did you copyright that?
I did not, and I was not the first person to say it.
Well, I'm maybe the first person to use it. Buy your self-cleaning oven from – okay. Let's talk about testosterone.
Okay.
What affects a man's sex drive? Why are some men – they really want and need to have sex every day? Why others – well, it's once or twice a week or once every second or third week?
Okay. I mean, I think – like we said with how people smell, everybody's body is different. Everybody's expectations are different. I think there's some of it that's physical. Some of it has to do with hormone levels. And some of it just has to do with what they've learned to or grown to expect. And I think everybody has different levels of libido. And sometimes that, you know, if you're really lucky, your partner has the same level. And for most couples, there's some negotiation there to get it right, to even it out.
What I would say, if you're smart, when you choose a life partner, that you make sure that your levels of libido are complementary. Because if they're not, it's going to lead to conflict. If you're someone who really expects sex every day and your partner only wants to have sex once a week, it will lead to resentment and fights and most likely end up in divorce. So make sure that it's complementary and understandable. It doesn't have to be the same. But it does have to complement itself because it could become a crisis.
Right.
I do think that it's also very personal. It's not just testosterone.
It's
what's in a person's head. Now, one of the myths that we have is that men who have larger penises often have greater testosterone. That's not always not true, by the way. Sometimes it is true. But is it a myth that it's always true?
Well, I think it's kind of a myth that it's all about testosterone in general. I don't think it's always true that penis size has anything to do with your libido. And I want to go just back for 1 second to what you said about choosing a partner who has similar libido to you. I think that's very true and very important in a relationship. Unfortunately, I think it changes over time and circumstances. So, for example, when you're parents of young children, I think people get very stressed out and very exhausted, and women in particular often have a lower libido at that time of their life. And so I think there's the most important part about it is communication and being able to talk about, you know, whether you want it, when you want it, and how important it is for the two of you.
I think the communication is extremely important because I don't think that women have low libido when they're stressed out. I think that they're pissed off.
Well, that okay? is a possibility,
and I think
too.
That they're pissed off because their husbands are not doing enough to remember that it's not a person that has a baby, it's a couple that has a baby.
Absolutely.
So that if they weren't pissed off, they get laid more. Okay, and they would realize that, you know, being intimate is really a stress reliever. So it's not a chore. Okay, so if they so the I'm fatigued, I'm tired is really I'm angry, I'm annoyed. You've really done nothing. Nothing has changed. You don't realize I'm doing all this extra work, and that's what it's all about.
I think there's definitely an aspect of that. I think there's also an aspect of when you're the mother of young children in particular. They're very needy. They want so much from you. And the idea that someone else wants something from you can also just trigger you, even if it's not your partner's fault, even if it's not that your partner has done anything wrong. So that's a big part to talk about as well.
Right. But see, here's the problem in what you just said, that one of the myths that growing up, that I grew up with, you know, being a little bit older than you or a lot older than you.
Yeah, not that much.
Okay. Is that sex is something that the women are doing for the men, okay? Like you hear women will say, well, I gave you sex. Well, what's the story? Women have more orgasms than men, okay? They're sexually superior to men by far on every
women
level.
Women should have more orgasms okay? than men. They can.
They can. But they definitely are sexually superior to men on every level. And for the most part, it's not unusual for a woman, you know, to be multi-orgasmic. And for a man, if he can be multi-orgasmic, it's great, but it's not the most common form. So women are not giving anything up to a guy. They're
Absolutely.
Getting more than they're giving. So the giving all day and not receiving is not the answer. The answer is whether or not, you know, again, back is to whether they feel that being intimate is something that they're giving or receiving.
Right.
And there would be nothing wrong, by the way, for a woman who worked the whole day and said, listen, I am tired and fatigued. I am going to take a shower, lay here, and you do me. And, you know, I'm just going to lay here and enjoy it and read a book and relax. Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Can I take us to another myth for 1 second? Because you brought something up.
Yeah, let's take us to another myth.
So there's a myth in here about the first time you have sex and about losing your virginity being the most wonderful, fabulous experience.
So what was it like for you?
It was not the most wonderful, fabulous experience. It was fine. Afterwards, he told me how we were probably going to see a little less of each other come the fall. So I thought that was a little bit shitty, but, you know. But no, I think one of the things is we really do set women up in particular because we talk about giving it away. It's a gift. It's a, you know, there's all these abstinence-only curriculum that are telling you that it's a special gift and you can only give it once. And if you don't, you know, if you don't give it to the right person, you'll have nothing
right.
left for the next
one. You know, if you give away the milk, you're not going to buy the cow, you know.
So I think we do set young couples in particular up for a big failure on that one with this
right.
whole giveaway and your virginity is a thing. It's an object or something that you have and you only can have it until you don't have it anymore.
Martha, you're so right. What we should actually tell kids is this, is that as you grow into your ability to experience pleasure, and when you're younger, you know, the pleasure will come in the form of making out, kissing, petting, and that sex is a simple, it's a part of that whole big production. And what happens is when people have sex for the first time, very often they forget about the making out and the petting and the kissing and the rubbing and the touching and all the cool things about being young and intimate and close. And parents are so afraid that their kids are going to rush towards sex that they don't properly educate them or speak to them, and also realize, you know, if you can't prevent something, then you need to at least prevent the consequences. So can we talk a little bit about the consequences? Today, in this country, let's talk about this country, mm-hmm. what's the status with HIV, with herpes? What's the status with the different diseases that come from unprotected sex? And is the rate going up or going down? Or what can or should be told or done about it?
Yeah, I mean, STDs are a pretty serious issue for young people. They're an epidemic. They really are. There's, as you mentioned, there's herpes, there's HPV, and there are a lot of STDs that young people can get from having unprotected sex. But I'm really glad that you said it that way, that you said unprotected sex, because I think what we often say to young people is, don't have sex because you're going to get this, this, and this. We don't tell them that there's a way to have sex and protect yourself at the same time. And I think that that's the important – we really give a very sex-negative message when we focus on consequences. I mean, we forget to tell kids in all of it that sex feels good. You know, recently my 8.5-year-old was asking me about how, you know, how a refresher course in how babies were made. She found out about it the first time when I was pregnant with her little sister, but she had some new questions. And when we talked about it, she said the very standard answer, or this very standard question, which apparently I also asked my father, so you did that twice. And I said, well, we've done that more than twice. And her question for that was, well, why? I mean, you don't want any more babies. And I said, well, the truth is that when you're a grown-up, it kind of feels good. And so people just do it for fun. And that is like a crazy concept to a kid. And we never actually put that out there. What we put out there is sex is for making babies, and for teenagers, it's dangerous. We don't give them any respect for the part of fooling around is fun, even in the backseat of a car. Fooling around is kind of fun.
You didn't grow up in a liberal Jewish home, right?
Of course I grew up in a liberal Jewish home with a father who has a PhD. Yeah,
my parents told me sex was fun, like, you know, when I was eight.
Mine too.
Okay.
But most did not grow up in my house or your house.
Okay, so you're right. And it is so cultural. It is so cultural. But what happens is you cannot fight nature. And everyone out there, no matter what your belief is, unless you plan to sit on your child and protect them, okay, and put them in special schools and so on and so forth, which is fine if that is your culture, if you're religious and this is your beliefs and you're going to do it anyway. But understand this. Understand that there is a biological reality to what a person feels and who a person is. In the same way that if a person is homosexual, you're not going to send them, you know, to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a hypnotist or anyone else and make them something other than they are if that's the way they're born.
That's one of our myths. People have been trying for years, and of course not. It does not work.
It does not work, and it's interesting. I was just speaking I was speaking to a client who was a priest, retired, and they used to have aversion camps, mm-hmm. where literally they would try to take a person who was homosexual and use aversion therapy, which now they would be in jail for. Okay, and
not necessarily.
Well, it all depends on the technique, right. But still, it is what it is. But let me ask this question: in the animal kingdom, do we see examples of homosexuality?
Of course.
Give me an example.
Well, there's the penguins at the Central Park Zoo. Have you heard about the penguins at the Central Park Zoo?
You mean Howard?
Is his name Howard?
Yes.
There's a book about penguins at the Central Park Zoo who had a long-term homosexual relationship and started nurturing a rock that they were treating as though it were an egg. So the zookeepers gave them an egg, and then they raised this child.
I want to know about the person who spent their time watching the penguins at the zoo, finding out that they were gay.
You don't think that would be fascinating? I'd sit there and watch the penguins.
I don't necessarily know if I would know if they were male or female. I don't know if penguins have displayed penises or vaginas.
You know,
I think
you'd
have to search a little bit. You know?
I do not know anything about penguin anatomy. I apologize for that. But yes, absolutely, we see homosexuality in the animal kingdom.
Okay, good. Is there any other examples besides penguins?
There was a story about bears recently, two bears. I can't tell you any more about that, but they were two. I think they were in Russia. They were two bears, and I can tell you more about that, because the reason it made the news was that what they were doing was oral sex.
They were doing oral sex.
On each other, yes.
Hmm. In prison, that's not considered homosexuality. It's just considered dominance. Interesting. So let me ask this. What are the myths about oral sex?
Do we have myths about oral sex in here? I don't even know. Is that a horrible thing to admit?
No. I mean, I think that what you find is in certain cultures, men will not have oral sex with women because they perceive the vagina as dirty where
Absolutely.
It's not. And in other cultures, it's just the opposite. Women will not give will not allow a man give man oral sex because there are fears of ejaculation within the person's mouth. So that fear comes up as well. So I mean, it really goes from person to person.
And it's a comfort with genitals. I think you're absolutely right. It's a comfort with yours and with your partner's.
Talk about bisexuality. Can a person be truly bisexual, or are they just gay and they kind of explore and experiment, you know, just to ease their conscience?
I think someone can actually be bisexual, and that's one of the myths we cover in the book, because, you know, people can choose and can understand who they're attracted to, and there are definitely some people who can be equally attracted to someone of the same sex or someone of the opposite sex, and they choose to enter into relationships with whoever they pick. And absolutely, it doesn't, you know, I think one of the myths is that if I say I'm bisexual and right now I happen to be in a relationship with a man, then I wasn't really bisexual to begin with. Or again, if I happen to be in a relationship with a woman, I wasn't bisexual to begin with. But I don't think that that's true. It's really, sexual orientation is all about how you identify yourself and who you find attractive.
Again, Martha, I completely agree.
This is fun.
This is really good. And some people are trisexual, which means they'll simply try anything. And
good for them.
Because at the end of the day, what they're really saying is, if it gives me pleasure and it doesn't hurt you, what is the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So bisexuality often comes as a form of where intimacy is created. If there's a tremendous amount of emotional intimacy and there's not taboos around, then sexual attraction can arise. Very often those taboos that are created through the environment in which you're born create the resistance, which is why there's so many people that even in marriage have guilt in sex, which is leads back to the, you know, to the answer of, well, you know, you had sex five times because they're five children. Because why would you have sex outside of wanting to have kids? And that joke is literally what so many people are raised to believe.
Well, and I think one of the things that we've almost gotten to the point in this country where it's okay that we have sex as long as we feel a little guilty about it, right? We're not where you were talking about Europe and you're just everything's okay and sex is part of it and pleasure is part of it. We'll talk about sex all the time. We'll show it in every single medium and, you know, we'll look at it on billboards and on TV and all of that stuff. But we still have to feel just this tiniest bit of guilt about it. There's just a little something put on us that we're doing something wrong.
Now, John, our engineer, I want to ask you something. When you grew up, did you grow up feeling guilty about sex?
No. No, I didn't. But I grew up in an Irish Catholic household, so it's a different story.
And not guilty about sex?
Nope.
You were a survivor. You are a survivor. That's you know, somebody was trying to explain to me why Irish guilt is more guilt than just normal Catholic guilt. Is that true, John?
Should bring my relatives on the show. Then you'll know for sure.
There's a lot of Jewish guilt, too.
Again, there's you know what? Let me define guilt. Is someone making you feel bad because you're not living up to their expectations? Okay. And as you grow up, as you grow into the job of a parent is to give a child the skill set to become who they can potentially be, not to make them who you want them to be. So the difference between genuine guilt and false guilt is genuine guilt is when you violate your own consciousness. I know it's wrong to steal. I steal. It's wrong. False guilt is when you violate someone else's consciousness. I'm being forced to be a doctor, and I really want to be an anthropologist, which may have no status in one's family. So, but I feel guilty because my parents, my poor parents, I'm going to put them in the grave if I don't go to medical school. You know what? An early grave doesn't kill anyone. Well, no,
wait,
hold it. It does.
I'm not sure about that.
An early grave does kill someone. Figured that out.
You said something in there that made me think of yet another myth in the book, which is about talking to children about sex, because you said that we're trying to prepare our children to be the best people that they can be. And I think one of the things that parents are really scared to do is talk to them about sex. And so we just don't. And then they're completely unprepared to be the best they can be when they...
And that's what we should do. We should talk to kids, you know, about having to be, how to be, number one, sexually responsible. But they should learn how to be the best sexual partners. How, you know, to literally be giving and to be receiving and to accept their own bodies and to accept the other person's. And how to establish limits and how to take the responsibility between emotional intimacy and making sure that you're not going out of your safety boundaries and making sure that you're always safe both emotionally and physically. But you know what that takes? It takes a relationship. Mm-hmm. Okay? It takes getting out of your comfort zone and realize that if you don't have the answers, then you need as the parent to get the answers.
And a lot of parents don't have the answers because we never told them about it.
Right? Out of all the 50 sexual myths, what is your favorite myth?
My favorite myth? That is a hard one. I think my favorite myth might be this one about young people being, you know, wild and promiscuous, because we start all these sentences with kids today. It's so different than when I was growing up, and they're all out there boffing like bunnies and, you know, hooking up with people they don't know. And I think if you actually look at the statistics over time, and granted, we don't collect a lot of statistics on what teens are doing sexually because we're often too scared to ask them. But if you look at the statistics, they're not doing anything that much different than the last few generations were doing.
Here's where I'm going to throw in where I think that you're completely on target and where it could be adjusted. Where there is excessive drugs and alcohol, there is more sex.
Yes.
Where there is not, there is less sex. Where you're in an environment, wherever that is in this country, that you are not only using alcohol, but you're using heavier drugs, cocaine, ecstasy, you know, hallucinogenics, and I could go on and on and on, there will be more sex. So the sex is not necessarily related culturally or religiously, but it does and is influenced by the amount of the drug culture surrounding you. So... In I, you know, grew up in the hippy dippy, days of the 60s and 70s, more coming into my own in the early 70s, obviously. But there was not as much drugs. There was more sex because it was the sexual revolution. But there's more sex now among kids that are younger because they're more exposed to sex as something that's cool. And they use drugs and alcohol earlier than they did when I was coming up.
Right. I don't know that there's more sex among young kids than kids who are younger. I do think that alcohol is a huge issue, especially when we're talking about college campuses. And I think one of the things that we're going back to that guilt about sex thing, right? One of the things that drives the alcohol use is to get rid of some of that guilt. We don't give young women in particular a license to want sex and to want to go looking for sex. And so one of the things that happens is a lot of alcohol use it does a lot of things. It relaxes you and, you know, acts as kind of a social lubricant, but then it also acts as an excuse.
Now, did you grow up or do you live in New York City?
I grew up in New Jersey. New Jersey. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on the Upper West Side as a kid.
I will tell you that in the city right now, they're having... it is very rare for someone to be in ninth grade and not having had sex. And that would not be true when I was growing up. Okay. We're looking at certain parts of the city, I will say the same thing would be true in the seventh grade. It'd be very rare to find someone not having sex. So there is much, much more sex going on now in at least in New York City. Again, you know, when you go out and you, this is a big country, it has a lot of religious areas, and that religion could hold you off, sports holds you off. The different things that, you know, hold you off because you need time and focus, and you need social acceptability. Okay, where now sex is more acceptable and it's more playful. It's not spin the bottle. It's actually there's more oral sex involved and there's more booze involved and it's taking a shot and so on, a shot of liquor. So there's definitely more of them. But I want to go back to getting across. I want to go back to the myths. Let's talk about the myths. How often do women have orgasm? What kind of orgasms do they have, and how often do they fake it?
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have as many orgasms as they should, and they fake it more often than they should. How's that?
So why is that? Is because they're not asking for it, or what?
I think a few things. I think some women aren't. Some women don't necessarily know how. You have to practice. It takes a little. Usually by yourself, it takes a little practice to figure out what it is that makes you orgasm. Some couples are relying too much on intercourse, which for many women isn't going to cause an orgasm.
Our audience is applauding you now. You know why? Especially the men. Okay, because what they're saying is that, listen, don't blame it on your partner. You know, practice makes perfect. If you're shooting 120 in golf, it's because you play golf once a year. If you practice, you know, sexually with yourself and you know what turns you on and you don't try to make the orgasm, to reach orgasm last a long time, especially as a woman, you could have more intense orgasms and more of them. So you need to practice. Good for you.
Although I'll say this. If you can orgasm in a couple minutes by yourself and your partner can't do it for you, then it's his fault and you got to teach him.
If you could do it in a couple of minutes and he can't do it for you, it's not necessarily his fault. Is that you've had more practice than he has on your own body.
You have to teach him.
You have to show him in a very playful way. Now, there are some guys, and this is kind of important. There are some guys... it's such a turn off to go a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, up, lower, harder, meaning they feel they should have a GPS. They're just getting instructions, and the south does not rise after that. It's another way to use moaning and body movement to, you know, if he's doing something right, to go, you know, to make noises that encourage and being a little quiet when he's going in the wrong way. Now, are there men who don't mind instructions? You know what? Ask the guy, what kind of guy are you? Okay? Because if you're the kind of guy who doesn't really want instructions and it's a total turnoff, okay, then your partner should know that. And then you're going to have to use a different method. Here's the bottom line, is everyone is different. And if you want to be with someone, make sure that you guys fit, or at least you're communicating to know how each other receives pleasure.
If the left and the right thing doesn't work, talk about it afterwards. Say, hey, you know, I really liked it when you did this. That movement with your finger was awesome. The other one, not so much.
And I'm going to say, just say the first. You know, you never have to say what doesn't work. Just say what does.
Fair enough.
Okay? Because if you just say what does work, the person gets it. Okay? If you're wearing a red sweater, okay, and you have red and black sweaters, and your partner says, you know what, you are so hot in red. I see, you know, you don't have to say black doesn't look as well on you. The message is there. Red's your thing. You know, so my suggestion is stay away from negativity as much as possible, because people just hear the negative. And when they hear the negative, it takes away from the positive. Okay, don't be the one who says, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you look so beautiful. Don't add, you know, after that. But when you put lipstick on afterwards, you look even greater. Dad, leave it the first way. You got it good the first time. Don't add anything to it. Anal sex. Talk to me about anal sex. One, is it where is it practiced? Is it common? Why does it seem like men crave it from women? Is it a sign of sexual dominance? Is it a sign of exploration? Tell me what the deal is that you have found in your research.
So I think it's much more common than we like to think. We still kind of think of it as either rare or something that just homosexual men engage in, and I don't think that that's true. I think heterosexual couples are engaging in it and have been engaging in it for a long time. I think it's a little taboo, which makes it a little sexy, right? And I think that that's one of the reasons why men think it's an interesting thing or a cool thing to try with their female partners, is it's just a little different, and it has this little bit of an edge to it in the way we think about it.
Yeah, I think there are two aspects to it. I think one is that in many cultures, with women, anal sex was permitted because they were still virgins, and therefore you were allowed to have anal sex and the feeling of ejaculation without the woman losing her virginity. I think
doesn't
also
that seem to send a really strange message about virginity?
I'm just telling you historically what has taken place. That's not in this culture. I think in this culture what it is that it is taboo in the sense that very often in relationships it would be the woman will say, well, the man will say, you know, that you are the only person I've ever done this with, which could be true. And therefore, sometimes it is the specialness of the relationship that we are a couple, and in the bedroom, anything goes between people who are this much connected, this much in love, you know, or this much committed. So I do think it's the edgy part of it. I don't necessarily think that there is anything taboo among consenting adults. Okay.
Oh, I agree. But you know, I do think that I don't think it should be taboo, but I do think it has an extra layer to it from society, from the way we think about it, that it has an extra bit of it's a little kinky, which is not a bad thing in my opinion, at least. It's not a bad thing. It's just something that maybe it means maybe it means we're a little closer. You trust me a little bit more.
Now, from a health standpoint, if you ask the question, if you're having unprotected sex, you do raise the danger of infection. You know, you raise the danger because the anus does bleed more, okay, and easier than the vagina does, and it's easier to get that blood transfer, for HIV. But one should not have unprotected sex anyway. And it's not obviously going to be as sparkly clean, because if you're going to prepare for it, then you're going to have to go more out of your way than just a shower.
And also lubricant. Lubricant is very important in anal sex. It's important in vaginal sex too, but that will help, by the way, cutting down on the anus bleeding for sure.
Yes, except for the guys who have such exceptionally small penises that is not necessarily. I'm sorry, guys.
And it always comes back to penis size, right? There we go. We're going to always come back to penis size.
No, we're just joking. Penis size, by the way, is one of the things when you want to understand anything, I tell people, you have two models to use. You have the anthropological or the historical model, and you have the molecular mathematical model or the model of the atom. And between the two, if you could find where they verge, you're going to find the truth, you know, just about anywhere. And penis size was one of the, you know, was one of the attributes in the cave where it meant something, just the way physical strength meant something. That the man who was 6 foot in the cave where everyone else was 5 foot and was stronger, he had dominance. He was the king of the cave. And he generally would have had the larger size penis, because there is a correlation between physical size and penis size. Now, is it always true? Absolutely not.
I've had finger size, apparently.
And that's not true either, because I have had football players coming in, you know, for both therapy and for hypnosis, because they were literally huge, both the hands, but they had average penises, where their other players, you know, had twice the size of the penis size. So it is usually true, both finger size or hand size or foot size, but it is not always true in the least. Midgets are known you know, to have above average penis size among all groups. Okay. So they don't have larger hands or larger fingers, but they do have larger penises. I guess nature has made up a way to just get there. Thank God for nature. What myth actually caused you to be surprised?
Oh. I don't know.
What myth made you say, I didn't know that was...
You know, I don't even know. I'm trying to think of one that surprised me. I like the myths about older people having a lot of sex. Those are good myths because we do think of sex as being something for, for the young and the beautiful.
Oh, older people have tons of sex. In nursing homes, oh my goodness, it is.
Makes you feel like you're alive again.
It's actually a problem in nursing homes because they don't know how to handle it. They don't handle it well.
They don't handle it well. Because there's no pregnancy involved, and usually there's no STDs involved. You know,
that's not necessarily
well. Sometimes
true.
There are.
This is a rising problem.
This is, I guess people worry less. But listen, if you're gonna have to go, that's kind of the way to go. I mean, like nursing homes, I think should be like colleges.
Are you suggesting
they should be rated? I think that they should be rated based upon sexual activity within a nursing home and food. I mean, come on.
They should be rated
give
on
them
food,
good
absolutely.
Food and a lot of sex, and then mind putting dad or mom in that home. So, they're getting fed, they're getting laid. It's enough.
Absolutely. Though the rising STDs in nursing homes is kind of surprising and kind of interesting. And I once wrote a blog piece on talking to your parents instead of talking to your children. Right, we're in that sandwich generation. Instead of talking to your children about the importance of safe sex, I wrote a piece on talking to your parents about the importance of safe sex. And I've got so many comments about, I would never in a million years do that. I could never have that conversation with my parents.
It's cultural.
I had that conversation with my grandmother.
Again, liberal Jew. I mean, it's a different story. You know, my wife among, her father, would never mention the word period. I mean, she grew up in Romanian culture. It's a different culture. So you don't make fun of other people's cultures, but it's just not going to be common. And to understand that you always, always have to respect another person's culture. We're simply talking, and we always will be talking about what is the facts that people should know. And as you grow, eventually you're breaking away and you're developing your own culture, your own belief. The interesting price that one pays between breaking away from the safety of a society that has its cultural norms into a place where you yourself create the own norms based upon your own belief and philosophy, there's both a good and bad to it. One, at least you're living your own life and you live and die according to those rules and beliefs that you choose to live by. And the other is that you're not going to have the same safety net as before. It's a choice. And everyone has to make that choice. And you make the one that makes the most sense for you. In life, there's always the ability to make choices and to accept those choices. That's how you know that you've grown up, that you it's okay that you can't have everything. So last question, we could go on forever, but unfortunately we can't, is alcohol and sex. Do you suggest it? Do you think it makes it better or worse?
I actually really did like writing that myth, in part because I learned that there is a academic theory that is essentially makes beer goggling an academic theory and an academic study. So that would be a fun thing to study in college. I think here's the thing about alcohol. I think it often is involved in sex, and sex is often part of, even if you're just going on a date and having a glass of wine, alcohol relaxes. Alcohol is part of our society, and we would never, and this is one of the things we say in the book, we're never going to tell you not to drink. We're never going to tell you not to drink or not to have sex, and we're never going to tell you not to drink and have sex. But we would like to warn people that sometimes it's not the best combination. For one thing, it doesn't do great for male orgasms. Men who have had too much alcohol have a really hard time coming. And so that's not going to make it all that much fun. For another thing, we can lose some of our judgment with too much alcohol. And I think one thing that's particularly scary is the amount of real binge drinking that's going on college campuses now. And that has a lot of physical implications and a lot of implications for sex as well. And I think, you know, you want to stay – you need to be a little bit rational when you're having sex. And also, drunk sex is not the best sex. I mean, I really think sober sex is better.
I mean, I would agree with you. I think sober sex is better, and I think that your mind and your emotions, if you allow them to take over – and to be the accelerant, I think they could take you to a much higher place than any drug on the planet could take you.
And you know what we said in the book? One of us had somebody pass out in the middle of intercourse. I don't know that I'm going to tell you which one. That is not good sex.
No, that is not good sex. You know,
he was heavy.
Don't have us tell. Martha, it was a total pleasure. Thank you for your book. Thank you for your time. And thank you for coming in person. It's so much fun when you come
in person. It's much more fun.
Okay.
We can smile at each other.
You got it. I want to once again truly thank Martha Kempner for coming on to our show. Pick up a copy of her book, 50 Great Myths of Human Sexuality, on Amazon.com. Also, check out her website at MarthaKempner.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Check out our other episodes on GluckRadio.com and on your YouTube channel by searching for Errol Gluck. Visit my website, GluckSolutions.org. If you change your thinking, you could change your life, and I could do that for you. If you want to learn more about clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching, that'll help as well. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. There's something here for everyone. Till next time.